Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts today, Greta Anderson, here with my co-host, Paul Wearson. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Greta. It's good to be back here, and I'm looking forward to interviewing folks from two community theaters that have productions opening this Friday. But that's at the end of the program, so I hear you've got some news about politics in Iowa schools, always a favorite topic of mine.
Yes, there have been a lot of developments in the State House early in the session. In past years, with split chambers, Republican House and Democratic Senate, the battle over education funding, or allowable growth, as it is called, got pushed to the end of the session, to the chagrin of school districts that had to set their budgets. This year, with both chambers Republican, it was one of the first items on the agenda, school funding, but again, to the chagrin of school districts, as the 1.1 allowable growth figure was the second lowest in 40 years and widely viewed by school superintendents as inadequate. Paul, your usual partner in the studio, Susan Franzen, could not be here today, but she interviewed the superintendent of Nevada School District, Steve Gray, who was just this year appointed to do double duty as the superintendent of Colonesco Schools as well. Steve appeared at the League of Women Voters legislative forum a couple weeks back, but his question to the legislators was not so much about funding, but about a bill drafted by Senate Republican Brad Zahn that would voucherize education or use public dollars to pay for private education. Here's Steve Gray, superintendent of Nevada and Colonesco Schools.
That morning we heard quite a bit about corporate tax cuts creating a decline in state revenues. And then to play that forward with the decline in state revenue, Senate File 29 proposes that public dollars fund private education through private schools, parochial schools, and or homeschool. Certainly not opposed to diverse options for students and families. That being said, this would be six out of the last 7 years we've had 2.2 or less. Now we're hearing from our legislators 1.1% allowable growth for public schools. So public schools have been underfunded for some time, and now we see a bill proposed to fund private with public funds. And so my question was twofold. One, where do we get those funds? The 1.1% that's being proposed is approximately, I think, about $40 million increase for public ed. I believe Herman Kornbach, in response to my question, indicated that to fund Senate File 29, to fund those public dollars would be over $200 million. So my question was twofold. One, where do those funds come from? If we don't have public funds to support public ed, where do we get the funds to support private ed? And secondly, if we have those funds, can we expect the same level of accountability for those public funds that we do when they go to public education? So that's a concern, because we certainly are accountable to those public dollars. And if we're going to divert public dollars to private needs, then there needs to be a similar level of accountability. I am a superintendent at two different school districts, Nevada School District. And this year, being my first year, that I'm also being shared at the Colonesco School District. So we have shared some transportation, maintenance, and things like that in the past. This year, we have increased sharing, both with my position as superintendent. We are sharing a director of school improvement for curriculum. We are sharing a transportation director, and we are sharing technology personnel. So we did that to create efficiencies, be the funding issue that we're talking about, in order for each of our districts to create efficiency, to free up more general fund dollars for our students and our programs. Over really the past couple decades, our population has shifted in Iowa. It's shifted from many rural areas to more populated areas. And with that, declines in enrollment in some of our rural schools has again exacerbated some of the budget problems, with budget being per enrolled student. That's one factor. So when your population is declining, when your enrollment is declining, And then you get inadequate allowable growth or state supplemental aid per student, such as the 1.1% that we're talking about this year. That can make it very difficult to sustain the programs that you have, particularly in those small school districts.
And now there's another problem that is it's related to funding, and that's open enrollment. How does that work in your districts?
Well, and I think that's a key point when we talk about, again, if we go back to the Senate File 29 and we're talking about vouchers and providing some kind of per-student education savings account to provide choice and so forth. We do have choice in our schools, and we have now for quite some time with open enrollment. Students' parents can choose to go to neighboring schools, and some do for various reasons. I think sometimes the assumption is that is always because of programs, or perhaps that they view some particular program in a school district better than others. And those are certainly reasons. And it may be a certain academic program, certain extracurricular program that may be driving that choice. But I've heard from many of the parents that I've surveyed over the years that it really has come down to logistical things, perhaps proximity. You may live in one school district, but really be closer to the attendance center in another school district. Or where parents, where the workplace is, our parents commuting to work, child care, all of those things can factor in to a person's choice to open enroll. In our districts, in the two districts, Nevada typically has more. We have more open enrolled in than out, typically. In Colonesco, the trend there, as I look back, has been more open enrolled out than in. But again, I think when you talk about Highway 30 and you talk about the workplace and where people are going, I suspect many of those people are going west, whether it's they're working in Nevada or Ames or Ankeny, and I think sometimes that plays into school choice as well.
Is there anything you'd like to say on this issue that I have neglected to ask about?
I think really the key point, sometimes folks don't get actively involved in the political process until it truly hits home in your backyard. And I think sometimes for students and parents, that's not until we see the cumulative effect of the underfunding become very real in our districts. And that becomes very real for families and students when programs are decreased or class sizes go up and those kinds of things. And unfortunately, by that time, usually a couple of years later, it's too late. So I hope that our folks will continue to engage with our lawmakers, continue to offer their opinions, and hopefully we can begin to rebuild the funding structure for public schools that's deteriorated over the last few years.
That was Steve Gray, superintendent of Nevada and Colonesco school districts. In terms of getting involved, folks in the Boone area this weekend can speak with their Senator Jerry Bain on Saturday at 8 a.m. in the Boone Public Library. And, of course, you can always go online, Google your representative, and send them an email. Well, I wanted to follow up with Senator Herman Kernbach, who is the ranking member of the Senate Education Committee, about exactly where this voucher bill was in the process and how likely it was to pass. Herman spoke with me on Monday night. That was a late night for his colleagues in the House, who were down in Des Moines hearing the public's views on proposed changes to collective bargaining for public employees. This is also a big issue for Iowa's schools and its teachers. So, Herman, the 1.1% allowable growth for education, that seems to be pretty much a done deal. It's passed the House and the Senate and presumably will be signed into law. Is that correct?
I believe, actually, it has been signed.
Okay. So now on the education front, there are a couple of possibilities that have been talked about. One of them is the voucherization of education, possibly the use of educational savings plans. Is there a bill that is getting any traction that relates to that type of thing, which would draw dollars away from public schools to be applied to either homeschoolers or to private education?
Right. Well, there is a bill out there that would do that. Among other things in the bill is abolishing the State Department of Education. Whether that bill is going to move forward specifically this year or not, I think is a little bit problematic. But I know that there are other senators who are interested, other legislators who are interested in moving forward with vouchers. The term of art is education savings accounts, but it's vouchers. It's taking public money out of the public schools and giving them either to private schools or to homeschoolers. I think that there are some real dangers with that, primarily to rural schools. You know, if you start bleeding dollars and students out of rural schools, the inevitable result is more consolidation. And how many times have I heard from people in small towns, hey, if we lose our school, we lose our town? I can't tell them they're wrong. I mean, what young family would ever settle in a town that didn't have a school? So I think there's a real threat there to rural schools and consolidation. I think that there are also some real problems with regard to some of the lack of controls with regard to homeschooling. I have great respect for the people who do homeschooling responsibly, so I'm not taking on a whole community there. But with the new type of homeschooling that was enacted about 4 years ago called independent private instruction, there is no accountability at all. So I have heard cases, for example, where kids have come into school looking pretty beat up. The school administrators are, of course, mandatory reporters. They had to call the cops. And the next week, the parent came in angry and pulled the kid out of school, said, I'm homeschooling him. And that's the last accountability with regard to their kids' education or even their safety that's likely to happen in the foreseeable future. So it's bad enough that we would let a violent parent or a drug addicted parent who couldn't be bothered to get their kids up in the morning, bad enough that we would allow them to pull the kids out of school and deny them their education. But then you top that off with vouchers. Well, then we're paying them to do that.
Okay, so you're saying that the bill that includes educational savings plans, aka vouchers, also includes a provision for the abolishment of the Department of Education of Iowa.
The one bill I believe a senator is on has submitted that bill. As I say, whether that particular bill moves forward, I think is problematic at this point. But I know that there are other people who are interested in creating a voucher program. So what legislation, what particular bill that would be embedded in, I don't know. But I foresee that, if not this year, I foresee proposals coming down the line in the next year or two.
I see. Any other specific threats to public education that you see in the current array of bills coming through?
Oh, absolutely. The bill that there's public hearing tonight in the House and probably will be begin debate in the Senate tomorrow to basically destroy collective bargaining in the public sector. Obviously, that affects teachers. That's one of the largest groups of public employees statewide. So most of the time, the two sides, they talk things out and nobody gets everything they want, but it's a system that respects teachers' rights, police and firefighters and, you know, snowplower drivers and nurses in public hospitals, all of that. It respects these people as individuals. It respects their rights to have a seat at the table. The bill that is before us would remove those protections. It basically would remove the requirement that if a teacher is let go these days, it has to be for just cause. If you eliminate that, then a teacher could get fired for anything or for nothing. I think that would really reduce the status of the teaching profession. I think it would drive teachers out of the state. I think that young people coming through our universities like Iowa State who intend for a career in teaching either would change plans or they would look for a job in some other state. You know, Texas is hiring. A lot of places around the country are beginning to experience teacher shortages. So is Iowa, by the way. And it's a very poor time to degrade the working conditions for teachers in Iowa.
I read a blog post that said that this labor law is just as bad, if not worse, than what was put forth in Wisconsin.
It's hard to imagine that we could do worse by our teachers or public employees in general than is done in Wisconsin. But, people who have studied the details tell me it's comparable.
You were there in Nevada at the League of Women Voters Forum when Dave Dio said that there would be two full days of hearings on any labor bill. Am I confused, or has that been pared down to something like 2 hours?
I think that's the correct understanding. I believe they're going to do 2 hours. They have hundreds of people signed up to speak. Obviously, only a small fraction of those are actually going to get a chance to, to have a say.
And is that typical of this year's proceedings?
Very much so. The education funding bill that produced this paltry 1.11%. And by the way, that's the increase in the allowed per pupil expenditure, all right? The actual state funds, some districts is going up, some districts is going down. Ames will lose, according to Legislative Service Agency estimates, Ames District will lose $1,145,000 in state aid. Now, some of that may be made up from other sources, but the other source is higher property taxes. So I think that the taxpayers and the students of this district lose on both ends there. When the allowable growth bill went through, the normal procedure is that a bill is introduced, the subcommittee is appointed, they schedule a time for a subcommittee meeting. You know, our rules say 24 hours in advance so the public can come and participate. And then, the subcommittee passes out, if the bill passes out, it goes to the full committee, and then there's, a noticed meeting. What they tried to do was to basically file a shell bill that had no content in it late on a Friday afternoon, come in Monday afternoon, only show their cards at the subcommittee meeting, which was a committee of the whole. It was basically not a subcommittee meeting. We fought that off, kind of a running ballot all day. This was 2 weeks ago today. At the end, they allowed 6 minutes for public input. 6 minutes. And then they passed it on through. None of the senators there knew what the impact would be on their individual districts. Senator Boehner, for example, over in Boone, he wound up cutting his own Boone school district by $500,000. He didn't even wait to hear the numbers. He went ahead and voted it through.
So how does it happen that the school allowable growth increases by, albeit a very small percentage, and yet a school district will lose money? How does that work?
Well, the allowable growth is the allowed per pupil expenditure. All right. So if a district is losing pupils, well, then eventually it's going to lose state aid. It's a complex formula. The property tax comes in at one level and then state aid and then more property tax at the top. If you have a change in the valuation of the district, if the property values go up, well, the initial layer of funding comes from a uniform levy, a uniform rate applied to that base. If your base increases in value, then your local district collects more property taxes. We don't want to go too far off into the weeds on that,
yeah.
Suffice it to say, with only a 1.11% increase in the per pupil aid, some districts are going to lose significant money, and that may only partially be made up from other sources, but the source is higher property tax revenues.
And that was Herman Kernbach. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI. This past Sunday, teachers from around Iowa gathered at the State House for a rally to oppose the various changes being proposed and signed into law by the majority Republican lawmakers. One of the speakers was so striking, I wanted to get her voice on the air and called her yesterday for a phone interview. Kelly McMahon got her training as a teacher in her home state of Iowa, but moved to Wisconsin in 2002. She taught preschool and kindergarten in Milwaukee schools for 9 years, then returned to Iowa in 2011 after the changes in state policy under Governor Scott Walker brought an unbearable toxicity, in Kelly's words, to issues of public employment and public education. As we heard in my interview with Herman, many are comparing the labor laws currently being debated at the Iowa State House to Wisconsin's Act 10. Now, Milwaukee schools already had their problems, says McMahon, largely because Milwaukee was the birthplace of the voucher movement. The percentage of students who go to charter schools there is about 30%. Here's Kelly McMahon describing what the voucher system looked like when she was a teacher in Milwaukee schools.
For 2 years at my school, we didn't even have someone to staff the library, and then finally the district implemented a one-day-a-week library rotation. Did not have a guidance counselor at my school at all, and that was very common across the district at all levels. The high schools were very understaffed when it came to guidance counselors. Art, music, gym. The teachers traveled between schools in order to actually get those programs back into the elementary school level because we didn't have the funds for them. That was a privilege to be able to have that. We had high turnover rates of staff, low morale. What would happen is they use taxpayer dollars to bribe parents to enroll their kids into the voucher or charter schools and then give them maybe it was money or it was like an iPad, and then they'd also use that to have them recruit friends to enroll their kids. So what would happen is then after third Friday of September, which is when we did our state official school attendance count, you would start seeing all the kids that were going to need special education supports or there were behavior concerns coming back into the public schools.
After they had gotten their goodies.
Yes, after they had gotten their goodies, after they had gotten their money from the state for the year. And every year, there'd be schools that closed mid-year. And we would be picking up kids mid-year because where else do you go in the middle of the school year and your voucher school that is supposed to be this great opportunity for your kid closed because they weren't paying their staff. And the principals of a school of maybe 200 kids was paying themselves almost $250,000. And then they would hire their own family to teach there. And it wasn't until probably about my fifth year in the state before we actually got some very basic accountability put in place, including licensure requirements.
And then you mentioned that Act 10 came along. Explain to the audience what Act 10 is.
Act 10 is Wisconsin's version of what is transpiring here in Iowa. It was a Koch brother Alec piece of legislation designed to bust unions. It totally attacked public employees' ability to negotiate with their employer. Areas that you could bargain for were pretty much wiped out. Union members could not have their union dues deducted from their paychecks anymore. And at that time, Wisconsin was still a fair share state. So even if you weren't a member, you still had to contribute to money that unions spent on behalf of negotiating a contract for you. So that's different than here in Iowa, where they are right to work state.
They canceled that provision, the fair share.
Yes. And so, like, my state education association was like 90,000 strong, almost 98,000, I think. And after Act 10, it's now about 34,000. So it's about the size of ISCA. It just fed into the whole idea that we were, you know, greedy people just wanting to line our pocketbooks, but that wasn't the case at all. You just want to be able to provide for your family and pay your bills and maybe not live paycheck to paycheck. With Act 10, one of the things was my ability to be an effective advocate for my students was really threatened. I spoke out a lot. I helped organize a community forum to address the inappropriate amount of testing and other developmental practices we had going on in our kindergarten and preschool programs in the city of Milwaukee. And that ability to be able to speak up, I didn't feel safe doing it anymore. And that was very, very important for me, like, to be able to speak up. You know, help parents. They felt like we're not getting what we need for my child. Help them navigate the system with the services that their child needed. And so I really felt like that was threatened. And so I'm like, I can't be the teacher that I need to be for my students. And I had moved away from my family. So I'm like, you know, I just think this is a time for me to move back home. I can be an advocate for my kids and I don't have to teach in such a toxic environment.
And Kelly McMahon did get a job teaching preschool in the Cedar Rapids School District and was happy being closer to her family in Manchester, Iowa. She enjoyed her work in the Iowa schools until this year's round of legislation, in particular, the collective bargaining bill that is being debated today.
We have a very large African refugee population, and I was one that would make sure that we reached out to those families. I would attend church services, go to their homes, making sure that they knew about registration and what paperwork they needed, and really just fostered a lot of great relationships. And so when the district changed the form of our preschool program, my principal actively advocated with the district to keep me here at my school because of the fact that I am so committed to making sure we're doing what's best for kids and building those relationships with our families. So it's been going great. I don't know that that's going to be the case. If they move my principal, the next one may not appreciate that I challenge some things that we're doing, you know, or the school board or the superintendent. And so I do worry now, like, am I going to be able to be the advocate that my students need when it comes to ensuring that we're doing what's best practice for kids, that we're not over testing them, that we're letting them learn through a natural way?
When you say that you feel that you might face those same types of fears, is that the no cause
yes,
part of the labor bill that teachers can be fired or public employees
yes,
can be fired without cause?
Yes, that'd be the fire without just cause. Yes. To me, I mean, in the private sector, you have to make a case for firing someone. But here, this law would change that for public employees. And, you know, you can disagree with someone that's in the power to make decisions, and they can say, you know what, we're just going to get rid of you if they implement what the bill is calling for, which is termination without just cause.
So have you been to the State House?
I have. I went last night. I went on Sunday. I've been to a legislative forum here in Cedar Rapids that we had. It's empowering, and it's very energizing, and it's very encouraging knowing that we're not individuals. There's members from all public employees that are sitting side to side, but yet seeing people walk out of the Capitol or not coming to hear what people have to say or the email responses that people are getting from their legislators is very disheartening. I know one teacher sent an email to state senator, I believe it was, asking them to vote no, and simply got an email response that said no. That's not how we should be talking. That doesn't help us find middle ground. It only makes it more divisive, and it doesn't make you want to work in a state that thinks so little of the people who go to work every single day to better the communities of Iowa.
Right.
And, like, all the people there that are there in support of public employees, it's amazing. It's just amazing. If I had heard all these people say such great things about public school teachers when I was in Milwaukee, wow, that would have been incredible.
So you're finding a lot of support in the Iowa community.
Yes, for all the public workers. But wow, to actually hear the appreciation of fellow citizens has just been it's just been amazing.
So I guess that's the silver lining here to what is a gathering cloud, making you feel a kind of deja vu having come from Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's totally deja vu. Like I was telling others, when that all went down, I was in the middle of spring winter conferences, and that's what I'm in the starting to do this week. But it's so different that it doesn't seem like it's tearing our state apart like what it did in Wisconsin. It seems as if it's bringing everyone together, fighting this assault on public employees, but also we have to fight the assault that's just on the regular worker with the House bill that wants to override local county and cities' increase in minimum wages. Those are the families that we serve in our schools. And we want those parents to be able to be super involved in their kids' life, and they can't when they're only making $15,000 at a job. So then for that's make another that's work another job. And I mean, this is just an assault on the working people of Iowa. And it's not okay. But we're all standing together and, you know, appreciating what each other brings to our communities. And so it's really nice. It's a nice change.
Well, Kelly McMahon, your students are obviously quite lucky to have you. Their families are lucky to have you.
Well, thank you. I'm very lucky to be able to be a part of my school and the families of the children that I teach. You can't have a more rewarding job than teaching.
And I hope you stick around in Iowa.
I will. My family will keep me here, but it doesn't mean I won't cry. And I'm definitely not walking away from any fight, because I know there's more coming, because I've lived them. And I've seen what this agenda is all about, and the children of Iowa deserve so much better.
It's Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio with your hosts, myself, Greta Anderson, and Paul Wearson. And Paul, I know I haven't given you much of a word in edgewise so far, but I also know you have views on our schools as someone who volunteers there.
Yes, I volunteer in the schools, both at Roland Story Community School, and I teach an 8-week course for the Retired Senior Volunteer Program on public speaking for fifth graders. And I'm at Colonesco in Nevada, and I know the people involved. And both in my volunteer work at Roland Story and the other schools, I'm uniformly impressed by the quality and the commitment of our teachers. And all of these, it was an excellent half-hour segment that we all could learn from. It's wise to know what's going on, what the forces at work are playing here, and actually, what kinds of things you can do directly to influence outcomes in the State House. And now I'm going to transfer to something lighter-hearted but more serious. What could be more serious than murder?
Murder.
But we're going to talk to a couple of folks here who are involved with the Judge Storey Theatrical Troupe in Story City. There's a dinner theater opening this weekend. And my guests are Sam Barnes and Joe Farrell. Welcome to our show, Joe and Sam.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for having us.
Well, now tell us about Let's Murder Marcia.
Well, this is a story, Judge Storey's Theatrical Troupe Dinner Theater we're doing this year. We have done this the past 2 years again after a little hiatus of doing dinner theater. So we open up tomorrow night, Friday night, and we run Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
What time are the shows, Joe?
Well, the Friday and Saturday shows are all sold now, so we just have the Sunday matinee, which is at, 1:30? 2 o'clock.
You better be there in makeup. So you're saying that the evening shows are already sold out completely.
We had to confirm the meal, so we have quit selling tickets for Friday and Saturday.
But speaking of the meal, what's the meal going to be?
We have two guys in a grill for the meals on Friday and Saturday. There's no dinner with Sunday. It's a show on Sunday.
Okay. And so they're going to eat, and then the show begins, right?
Food and a show.
Food and a show. Sam, what's your part in this murder mystery whodunit?
We've got seven in the show, and I am the role of Tobias Gilmore. Tobias is the husband of Marcia, of course, who the show is named after. And
I'm sorry to hear about your wife, Tobias. She's headed for the dregs.
Yeah, right? It's going to be rough. But yes, Tobias's role in the show is as a loving husband to Marcia, but he becomes very concerned with her love of mystery reading, and I think maybe she takes it a little too seriously.
Really?
Yeah.
So she's so deeply into murder mysteries, and it's really highly addictive, and you as her husband are saying she's going off the deep end.
Exactly. She should quit reading those books. She should read the classics like War and Peace.
Right, so the plot thickens. And Joe Farrell, how do you come into play in the play?
I come in as the next-door neighbor, Virgil, that Marcia reaches out to once she thinks Tobias is about to kill her. So I come over to help her deal with this situation.
And so this is sort of coming to fruition in her mind that things lead her to believe that her husband's about to knock her off.
Yeah, she overhears some portions of a conversation that makes her think that Tobias is plotting against her.
And then you, as Virgil, you do something about that. We don't want to give up the whole show here. But
I am there to help her. When she reaches out to me, I come running.
And so, really, the plot thickens, and all kinds of other people get involved also. Is that right?
Yes, we have
Persis, the interior decorator that is working with Tobias. We have a police officer that arrives. We have Marcia's mother, and we also have the Bianca, the maid, that is kind of in the background pushing a lot of buttons as she goes through.
Yeah, this dinner theater is fascinating because, number one, it's what, was it two or three acts or just two, one act? Or
it's a three-act show we're going to do in two acts.
Really? Okay. So what it is, really, the traditional dinner theater is either lighthearted farce or murder mystery or these sorts of small bits of entertainment that, in my knowledge of Judge Story theatrical troupe history, helped to finance this community theater in Story City, because the segment of the year for Judge Story always was the dinner theater fell in February after the initial production in December of the Children's Theater, and then you had this dinner theater run, and then you do a big show in the spring at the Story Theater there in Story City. And of course, when you look at community theater, the big problem always is, as anywhere, cost. And for instance, in my experience, I did My Fair Lady in 1998. I played Henry Higgins. And that was a big show. We sold out completely, but it was very costly, too. And these big shows everyone knows about, like My Fair Lady or Sound of Music Carousel, still have a hefty royalty. And so Judge Story has the income opportunity for the children's theater around Christmas, and then you have the dinner theater, and that has a low royalty, these small plays like you're talking about, so that money could be made to support the big show in the spring. And I was concerned, too, that we were not doing dinner theater because that was our income opportunity. How did it restart, Joe? Do you know what happened there?
Yeah, we were really lucky. We had, Jamie Kornstrom's directed last year and this year, and she stepped up and has really taken a lead on getting this reestablished, making the connections, working with Guys with Grills, working with Viking Hall where we're having the venue we're performing at. So I got to put a lot of credit for getting the dinner theater up and running again on Jamie, because she has stood up. And last year was her first time directing, and she did a great job. She's been Sam and I were both in her production last year, and it was a lot of fun to work with. And she found another one for this year. She's already got next year's show picked out. So this looks like a thing we're going to continue doing.
So you've talked about what I know is the lifeblood of theater and community theater: the ability to have and recruit directors who are willing to do what they need to do to make a show happen year after year. So here you're saying someone stepped up to revive something very necessary to the troupe, and they're willing to do this and model that behavior for people who might follow. And I'm talking about that I'm not digressing from the show as much as to educate people on how community theater's done and how people come in and have to do the real legwork and heavy lifting to make this happen every year. But once you get on stage, it's really fun. And Sam, what's fascinating about your part to you?
Well, I mean, I guess first and foremost, I just enjoy the process. The best part is working with the other actors and the directors and you know, the costume people and the people that do sound. Just working with the group, I think that's the most rewarding part for me, is the process of putting it together. But the fascinating part about, I guess, fascinating thing about my part as Tobias, I think, is just how he kind of, you know, I think goes from thinking everything's kind of okay one day to things turning into kind of a crazy mess all in the course of a day. It's a pretty emotional roller coaster for Tobias to go through. So it's a lot of fun to go through that, actually.
So every performance you're taking Tobias through this growing awareness of something crazy going on, and
yes,
that's just plain fun. Yep. And then Joe, as playing Virgil, you've got some other dynamics going on in your part, right?
Yeah, Virgil's an interesting character. He has a lot of range of what we can do with him. So trying to figure out where we were going to go with him and how he was going to react to things has been a really interesting experience. We've tried a lot of different things over the past couple months trying to figure out where Virgil is and who he is.
And who's playing Marcia? The namesake of the show.
We have a returning actress, Bailey Kornstrom. She was in our show last year, Death by Design. So she's coming back this year and is taking the lead role of Marcia.
And she's fun to work with, too. You know, having done community theater, Sam, you actually hit it on the head. It's this quasi-family that develops over all this time of rehearsal and production. And you all are headed toward this opening night. And you know, it doesn't matter. Like when I played Henry Higgins, I was doing the same thing, that the man who made it famous was doing every night. It was the same challenge. And we had 20 people in the orchestra, but just like he did. And so all the dynamics are the same, you know. I'm not this famous actor, but my assignment's the same. And because that particular actor owned that part, I had to approximate his performance. So every night the lights went on, I had to do that. And that's true of every community theater participant and actor anywhere in the United States and in the world. You get that opportunity to create an illusion. And whether you're paid thousands of dollars a week on Broadway, or you just get the fun of playing a role with your friends, when the audience is there and the lights come up, the same thing is required of you. And so everyone works toward this, and then there's opening night and the run of the play, and there's a cast party. Then you miss everybody.
We've already been talking about what we're going to do next week when we're not getting together.
It's terrible. And, you know, what a wonderful process that you – when did you begin rehearsal on this?
You know, we started back in November.
Okay. So look at all the bonding that happens because you started prior to the holiday season. Mm-hmm. Here we are in February. It's production. And you're clicking, aren't you? And the other thing you find out – is that every audience is different.
Oh, yeah.
And remember to leave space for the laughs. Because you don't know who will laugh on what night. And the different lines that get a different laugh will fascinate you. Now, why did the audience laugh at that when last night's performance, that line didn't have a response at all? Am I in familiar territory?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, those times when you think you have the joke that's going to kill and it just, there's crickets out there. It's like, why wasn't that funny this time?
Yeah, and then you think, thank God I'm up here with my friends. Hey, so refresh us again now. This is going to be Let's Murder Marcia. It'll be at Viking Hall, which is in the second story above the City Hall area, right near this famous Story Theater.
Correct.
And there's elevator access through the city building.
Yes.
And then you can come up the stairs, too. And this area was a hotel before, so there are windows all along. Those used to be hotel rooms.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I didn't either.
That's why there are so many windows there. And that's called Viking Hall. And you get up there, you have dinner, and it's going to be Friday night is opening night?
Yes.
What time is the show?
7:30 the show starts. Dinner starts at 6:30
dinner. And the dinner tickets are sold out for Friday and Saturday, is
correct.
That right? But there are also theater show-only tickets?
Show-only on Sunday.
Okay, good. And that matinee is what time? 2 o'clock, I'll probably guess.
2 o'clock. Know?
So, Judge Story Theatrical Troupe Story City opening this weekend. Let's Murder Marcia. Featuring the stars we were lucky to get today, Sam Barnes and Joe Farrell. So go see Community Theater at Judge Story Theatrical Troupe, Viking Hall, Story City. This weekend, have a pork chop and a great show. Thanks, you two.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Sam. Or Paul.
Thank you. All right, we had fun with that, that's for sure. Now, we're going to go north to Webster City, and this is the Community Theater. It's called Murder on a Budget. So Joe and Sam, here's Murder on the Cheap here. It's opening on Friday evening also, but it's an original play written and directed by Sally Evans. And we have Sally on the phone. Are you there, Sally?
I am. I'm here.
What did you think about all the stuff we've been talking about with Judge Story here? Isn't that fun?
Yes. Murder can be funny.
Yes. Well, now tell me. A little bit about this show here. First of all, let's get the business out of the way. When is the show being produced and where? I know in Webster City. Tell us about it, Sally.
Okay, we open on Friday night also at 7:30, And we run this weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then the following weekend, the 24th, 25th, and 26th. Our evening shows are at 7:30, and our Sunday matinees are at 2. Tickets are $12.
Okay. Now, tell us about this show being your brainchild. Are you the playwright?
Well, yes, I am. I've written 5 plays, and they were all done specifically for the South Hamilton Foundation as fundraisers for an annual event they used to host. It was a murder mystery dinner theater. And because of my involvement with the Webster City Community Theater, some of my friends from there attended and then suggested that we do some of these plays up there. So Murder on a Budget is the 3rd one that we've done in Webster City. The other 2 were House Guests Can Be Murder and Murder in Black and White.
Wow. So this is a big history for you in terms of doing this type of show and doing those things in a fundraising aspect where you actually had a motive to not only put on a show, but raise money for a community effort, and that's commendable. Now, tell us about the production site up there in Webster City. This is what building is this, and how do you find it, and all that sort of thing?
Well, the address is 1001 Wilson Avenue, and it's on a corner. It's a former church, and it still looks a little bit like a church, although there are awnings outside on the on each side that kind of define it. I wasn't involved in the original renovation of the building, but it's gone through many phases, and we just added a big addition on the back.
Okay.
And it's really one of the nicest community theaters around. We've got a nice big stage, a lot of good lighting, comfortable theater seats, so it's a really nice theater.
Now, about this show, how is this a show about older people or what? I've heard the cast is
well,
older.
It's the thing is, it's a class reunion.
Oh, good.
And the class had saved up a lot of money to take a luxurious cruise, but their class treasurer embezzled the funds. So they had to go in the off season on a rusty old ship with only 1 crew member and a captain who thinks he's James T. Kirk.
Wow.
So not only is the weather lousy, but the food is bad, the cabins are small, there's a creepy guy in one of the deck chairs, and to top it off, a murder.
A murder, oh no. And this all came from your mind during a night of fitless sleep, I suppose, right? How did this come to me? And it's really fun. How large is your cast up there, Sally?
We've got 7 men and 6 women.
Mm-hmm.
And originally, this was entitled The 68 Higby High Reunion Cruise or Murder on a Budget. But that was too long a title for the posters and the tickets and the electronic sign in front of the theater. So I just shortened it to Murder on a Budget. But these are all classmates then, and then we've got the captain and the 1 crew member who is the purser, doctor, cruise director, first mate.
Wow. I just think it sounds fascinating, and I love the fact that you put together a show where you have a mature cast, since I'm such a mature person, you know. We were talking with the Judge Story people, and I think their cast tends to be young, and here you have a cast that's what I would call more mature, right?
So yes.
How difficult was this show to cast?
Well, actually, we have a pretty good group of that age.
Good,
so it
good.
Wasn't that difficult. You know, I think it's more difficult to cast roles for men in their 30s and 40s because they tend to be busy with their jobs and their families and don't have time to rehearse 3 or 4 nights a week for 6 weeks.
Up in Webster City, what is the usual format of the year? Are there several performances by the community theater per year?
We usually do 4, sometimes 5 shows a year.
Good. So this fits into the winter theatrical season, and people look forward to this. So they know this type of production is going to be available in February every year, right, Sally?
Approximately.
Now,
March.
how often are you involved? Or we talked earlier in the other segment about the real necessity of people being willing to step up and direct. And that's the key, I believe, in Webster City or anywhere where you want to do a regular schedule of shows. So you're fortunate up there, I believe, to have willing directors. Is that correct?
That is correct. We have several. And we have people who like to learn, too. So we always have someone be an assistant director before they actually take on the role themselves.
And so how's this production been going? Are you proud of what's happening up there on the boards?
Oh, yes. We had an excellent, excellent rehearsal last night. We're ready to go.
Good. And opening night again is Friday. And yes. Be sure and remind people again that the show is Murder on a Budget, and the production times and dates are?
February 17th, 18th, 19th. And
that's Friday, Saturday,
25.
Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then 24, 25, 26. Evenings at 7:30, Sundays at 2.
Very good. Well, you know, I think you'll have a good run. And sure. Do you have a lot of pre-ticket sales going on?
Yes, yes.
How's that going? Okay.
Going well. Yes, and we get good coverage in the Webster City paper, good publicity.
And then another thing about community theater, what sells tickets and brings in the money you need to support the program is the actual experience people have in the theater environment that night. And that means consistently competent directing. It means people from the community who not only are on stage, but you've got a crew, too, that helps behind stage. We know in theater that there's all kinds of publicity and materials that have to be done and organized. How many people really were involved? When you talk about this show, you know the number of the cast, but what do you think you've got there? 20 people, maybe? What does it take to put on a show?
Yeah, that's about right, 20 people.
20
and
people.
And that's very true. It takes a village.
Yes, it does. And we were talking earlier, too, with the Jet Story people about, hey, this is a family that grows over production time, and I'm sure the same chemistry is happening there where everyone's been working on this show, and now it's going to open, and when it's over, and it's bittersweet, right? Mm-hmm. You know what's going to mm-hmm. happen, right, Sully?
Yes, that's very true.
Okay. Uh-huh. Well, thank you, Sally. That was wonderful. We've been talking with Sally Evans of the Webster City Community Theater. And thank you, Sally. And that was Sally Evans producing Murder on a Budget, opening at the Webster City Community Theater on Friday, February 17th, repeating on Sunday the 18th and Saturday the 18th, I should say, and Sunday the 19th. The play will continue next weekend also, the weekend of February 24th, 25th, 26th. And as we close, we should remind people of the plays announced in past weeks that will be closing this week. Neil Simon's Plaza Suite has one more weekend in Boone and a Sunday matinee at 2, as well as a final week of Ankeny Community Theater, The Fantastics, that great show, will be this weekend, February 17th to 19th. So wherever you are in our listening area, you can go north, you can go south, and see great community theater.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa. We've been your hosts, Greta Anderson and Paul Weirson. You heard from Steve Gray, Superintendent of Nevada and Cole Onesco School Districts, State Senator Herman Kernbach, and kindergarten teacher Kelly McMahon from the Cedar Rapids School District, comparing her experiences in Wisconsin to those she foresees with the new labor legislation that may be voted on today at the State House.
And we also heard previews of Murder Mysteries opening this weekend from Joe Farrell, Sam Barnes, and Sally Evans in Story City and Webster City, respectively.
Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. Thanks to webmaster Ron Carson for making that possible.
And Local Talk was engineered today by Greta Anderson. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards. And that's from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
And Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878 or through our website, khoifm.org.
And if you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. And remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening again, folks, and see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.